Welcome to the Center of Everywhere podcast, where we explore stories of rural Minnesotans who are making a difference in their communities. Rural isn't in the middle of nowhere. It is in the center of everywhere.
Welcome to the Center of Everywhere. My name is Kelly Ash, Research Associate with the Center for Rural Policy and Development. On this episode, I got an opportunity to sit down with Minnesota State Demographer Susan Brower, where we discussed our surprise that Minnesota kept all 8 of its congressional districts, how our high self-reporting rate likely helps the accuracy of our data, and our concerns of the U.S. Census Bureau's plan to add noise to the data. And welcome to the Center of Everywhere. Today we have State Demographer Susan Brower to have a conversation about the most recent data release from the U.S. Census Bureau. And Susan, thanks a lot for taking the time to join us.
Hi, Kelly. Thanks for having me. Good to be here.
So, big announcement yesterday. I think it took a lot of us by surprise. For anybody listening right now, Minnesota managed to keep its 8th congressional district with the release of the census results, and we were all pretty shocked. Susan, what's your feeling about the whole thing?
I knew it was within the realm of possibility. I've been telling people that for the last couple of years, saying, no, it's still in striking distance. I'm not saying it's going to happen, but it's in striking distance. And I would kind of watch people politely nod at me with disbelief. So I won't say I was completely surprised, but I'm really happy that we landed on this side of things.
And I don't know, Susan, I've seen you present a few times over the last few months, kind of talking about, you know, what the estimates were looking like and what that meant as far as the number of people that would be represented in each congressional district and the size of those congressional districts. I don't know, do you have those numbers off the top of your head for our listeners? Like, what were the ramifications if we were to lose a congressional district? What was that going to look like?
Yeah, so if we went down to 7, each of the districts in Minnesota would be about 810,000 people. And as it is today, because we kept that 8th district, it's about 100,000 people less. So our districts are about 710,000 instead of 810,000. So quite a difference. If you think about all the geographic area that you would have to expand the rural districts by to cover 100,000 more people, you have to go pretty far. And so that would probably mean redistricting those 7 districts more into urban areas and kind of more mixed communities and community interests.
Right. So good thing we kept it. It kind of keeps representation at a little bit more of a reasonable level. I'm sure some of our congressional members are pretty appreciative. I remember some of our Congress people got their licenses because they would have to fly across their districts just to meet with constituents back in the day. So
yeah,
the less those have to grow, the better.
Yeah. And something that wasn't publicized yesterday, which I think is really fascinating and hopefully gratifying for people who helped with census outreach, was the margin was so thin. It was so thin. They were reporting yesterday that New York State would have had to have counted 89 more people in order for them to get that last seat that we got. But the formula also works in a strange way. If Minnesota had counted 29 fewer people, we also would have lost that seat. So the margin, if you helped 29, you know, that's just a handful of households, right, get counted. That's the margin by which we retain this seat. It's pretty remarkable.
It really is. And, you know, one thing I think I want to take a little time today was talking about some of those nuances and maybe going into a little more detail behind some of this stuff. And I know some of it is complex, but why don't we start by talking a little bit about the difference between, you know, the past few months. A lot of folks were kind of talking like, yeah, the estimates were looking like this and the actual counts. Can you explain the difference, the numbers, you know, your office was looking at leading up to the release of the data and then now this, and why there might be a discrepancy between the estimates and the actual count?
Sure. So the population estimates that are put out every year by the Census Bureau, and our office puts out another set of very similar estimates, we take the last census as our base or our yardstick. That's the number we know is good. It's complete. It counts everyone. And we build on top of that what we think the growth or decline was. So as you get further and further away from a census year, your numbers tend to get more and more inaccurate, because you just don't have that full count that's been there to ground you. So we knew that getting 10 years out meant that those estimates could be off, 15 to 20,000. We'll go back and look now kind of retrospectively at the last few years and see how far we were off. But we knew that 15, 20,000 wasn't an impossible stretch to say that might be within the error of these estimates.
Do we know yet then how far the estimates were off from the actual count yet?
We can look at 2020. I don't have the number in my head. I know that we had, I think our number, it's on our site. It was 5,680,000 or so. And the Census Bureau came up with about 5,700. So for the state overall, about 20,000. It sounds like a whole lot of people, but it's a tiny little margin if you're building up errors over a decade.
It's always fascinating to have conversations with people that aren't, fully in the know of how this stuff puts together. And you talk to them about this stuff and they almost find it hard to believe how really, truly accurate a lot of this stuff is. I mean, it's really incredible. And it's why the data, we find it so important and so useful as we do our work.
Yeah.
I'm curious, so we, it's been talked a lot about that Minnesota did really good. We're number one, I guess, in self-reporting, the highest rate. It was 75.1% or something like that.
Yep.
Sound about right. I guess just talking about Minnesota as a whole, and then we'll kind of jump into some of the differences in the self-reporting. But why do you think Minnesota as a whole does so well on this? Is it tied to just civic duty or what is it?
I think it's a combination of Minnesotans being generally oriented toward doing their civic duty, towards wanting to help their communities, and to, it's tied in with voting, all those activities that people are kind of oriented outward to community. I think that's really strong here. And we see it in, voting participation rates, and we see it in past census response rates and volunteerism. We see all these indicators that Minnesotans generally act in this way. But on top of it, we had this tremendous kind of grassroots effort that was pretty well funded this time around. More so, I think, than in past censuses. The legislature had an appropriation of $1.6 million, a one-time appropriation just for census outreach. And then there was an effort to raise money from local foundations as well as private foundations as well for this. So all kinds of, townships, cities, counties, but also nonprofit groups, advocacy organizations, labor unions, across the board, people kind of got involved in this in a way that they haven't in other censuses. And so I think the combination of just being kind of predisposed and relatively trusting of government, I'm not saying everyone, but relatively trusting of government, and then having this really big outreach effort probably got us where we were today.
So with that said, there were some pretty significant differences in self-reporting across the state of Minnesota. So it's not like the entire state was at 75%. It looked like particularly the seven county metro and more of our kind of urban centers, even in greater Minnesota, were probably closer to that 80 to 90%. And then we have places, particularly in northern Minnesota, where, you were lucky to get half self-report rate. What are some of the differences? Why do those differences exist in your mind? Is it anecdotal or do you have some research to back that up?
So in the rural areas, historically, we have seen lower self-response rates. And in Minnesota, in the northern part of the state, in past censuses, we've seen lower response rates as well. We saw that in 2020. And there's a number of things that are going on that kind of lower those response rates in those areas. First of all, we know just generally in the US that there are lower response rates in rural, low-wealth communities. Second, many of those areas have Indian reservations, and many of those tribes have chose in 2020 to get the census form in another way, and that's with a census taker coming to the door. And so when we were looking at some of the responses initially, we just had to be careful to make sure that we weren't combining both ways of responding to the census. Another thing that happened that happens with response rates is you have all kinds of seasonal home in northern, if it's hunting or, you know, cabins. Later, those will be taken out of the denominator, so you'll just get a pure response rate of households that were eligible to respond. There really was a family or a group of individuals living there. But for now, that gets all kind of mixed in. And so what looks like a lower self-response rate is sometimes attributable to just vacant housing or seasonal housing.
Yeah, I think that's a really important piece. And it's always interesting when we're doing research or talking about data with folks. There's always this case where Northern Minnesota is just a little bit different compared to the rest of Minnesota, and a lot of the data and metrics that we look at, and you're absolutely right, it usually is attributable to seasonal housing. The higher prevalence of reservations and our American Indian populations, they just have different trends, and it just really kind of looks different up there. And then also, I think on top of that, there is a culture of like, leave me alone.
Yeah.
Right. You know, that's why fair. You do the Northwood.
It's good. There are the woods to go to, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Beautiful place to go. Something I'll add is a map that is called a hard to count map. And it was coming out of one of the universities in New York. I'll send it to you so that you can link to it. But it shows the response in 2020 compared to 2010 at the tract level. And what I think is really interesting, particularly for northern Minnesota, for the rural part of northern Minnesota, is that you have areas that outperformed by far their 2010 rate. The area around Itasca County, which had a huge outreach going, I know. And you also had areas that fell far behind. And you had areas that were really pretty close on par with their 2010 number. And so I think the story for northern Minnesota in particular is that it was just really all over the map in terms of comparison with the historical numbers.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, I haven't seen that. That's cool. And for our listeners, we will put that on the post and on our website at ruralmn.org. Come take a look. Susan, so tell me a little bit then about, I know you have spoken in the past about having some concerns about some of the accuracy and how things were gathered. Obviously, it was a crazy year to try and implement a census.
Yeah.
What are some of those concerns you might have, and how do you see this kind of playing out in over the next year or two?
So I think one thing that might help people kind of understand the challenge is just to give the example of college students and how they were or weren't counted this time around. And, you know, related to the timing of the pandemic, college students were sent home or sent to do remote work just at the very time that enumerators were set to do a special count of college student areas of off-campus housing that contained a lot of college students, that those areas had already been isolated, and the Census Bureau was about to send out enumerators early before those students went home for the summer. Well, the pandemic came right at that time. The enumerators couldn't go out, and the students moved. And there wasn't clear instruction for students who moved home or moved to another residence. You know, it might have been out of state, it might have been in state, but in a different county. You know, some students, if they could, went, you know, back overseas who should have been counted here. And so there was just all this movement of students at the exact same time when they're about to be counted. And so I raise that as an example. There were things that were done to try to counter that, to try to capture it, you know, both through the colleges and universities and through other kind of mailings and things. But I raise that as an example, as this is a really unusual, really difficult census. And, you know, the questions still remain, how well did this census catch everyone?
And just for our listeners, I think why this is a big deal, particularly for rural areas, just using that example, I'll use the University of Minnesota Morris, right? So Morris has about 5,000 people, 1,800 of them are usually University of Minnesota Morris students, right? Like somewhere around there usually. And that's a big deal. That's a quarter of, or a third, 20% of the population in Morris that, yeah, it's kind of up in the air right now. Hopefully they got counted, but it's tough. It's hard to know. And I would argue too, a lot of those students at Morris, I forget how many now, are from China. And so it really does raise a lot of questions if they all kind of went home and what that looks like. So yeah, interesting. Well, on that note, then we're looking at a very slim margin that we kind of held on to ours, and a very slim margin in which New York lost one of their seats. Sounds like they're going to file a lawsuit. And I know it sounds like there's been a couple of lawsuits in the past where states have tried to change the count or the number because they lost a seat or whatever. All of them have failed. Have you heard any preliminary ideas of like what a lawsuit might challenge? Is it those types of questions that they'll probably be challenging?
I think so. I mean, I don't know any specifics other than to know that when we were still kind of in the period where the count was still going on, that some of our counterparts in other states were being asked to like keep good notes because this is wacky. So keep good notes so that, you know, we at least know kind of what the timeline was of all these events happening or failing to happen. So I don't have any details about, whether a lawsuit will come. There are some lawsuits that kind of came through over the past couple of years related to the 2020 census, some of which are still outstanding, but they're not yet related to the count because those numbers were just released yesterday.
Okay, yeah. Kind of jumping around here a little bit, we kind of are harping on this accuracy piece in the process. Is there an easy explanation you have for why having such a high self-reporting rate helped us? And I'm using air quotes for our listeners.
Yeah.
Does that help Minnesota? I mean, we should be able to say, no, every state is accurate now. But so can you kind of pull that apart a little bit?
Yeah. So there is research that looks back at past censuses to try to gauge how accurate the count was. And there'll be one that's going, there's one that's going on right now. So we'll get the results from this one in the future. But one of the things it looks at is the accuracy of reporting based on the type of response that was gathered. If people don't respond to the census themselves, what happens is a building manager, a mail carrier, a neighbor responds on behalf. And in these studies, when they go back to check, they find that the reporting is much more accurate and complete when it is a self-response instead of a proxy response. And so I can't give a number like how many more people we counted because we have had we had 3/4 of our households respond by themselves. Actually, the number would even be higher than that because there was self-response once the enumerators went out into the field. But, you know, regardless, I can't say what that number is that we gained because of that. I just know that there's research that shows that if you fill out that form yourself or you tell the census taker your information yourself, it's more accurate than if your landlord is telling them the information.
Yes, excellent. Thank you. And probably for our listeners, it's probably worth mentioning that, yes, the decennial census is incredibly accurate, but it always does have a margin of error. There's always going to be a little bit of error. Do you have any idea usually what the margin of error is in some of this?
You know, it's I'd be happy to point you to those numbers. Typically, it's very small. So even though we're talking about the errors and or we talk about kind of how groups are counted differently, differential undercounts, the numbers are very, very small. And, you know, the collection of data was well over 99.9% of all households. So in one way or another, that information was collected, but there still remains a little bit of error in there.
Yeah. As researchers, we would probably make the claim that it's pure.
There's nothing more. There's no better data than a decennial. So there's no more complete data, even though it still has its warts, I guess. It's still, there's nothing better. So,
yeah. Well, I guess this is all leading up to then a kind of recent change that the U.S. Census Bureau has announced in how they're kind of going to add a little error to the numbers, to the data, in order to make it more challenging for folks to be identified in the data, right? To kind of add some privacy and some mechanisms. But this might have some repercussions for rural Minnesota and for our listeners. It's called differential privacy, and you can Google it and take a look at it. And I don't know, Susan, do you have like a quick explanation of kind of what that is and why it might be problematic?
Yeah, I'll give it a try. So this is something the Census Bureau has never used before. It's always used different. It's always used some method to protect privacy, but this is a new method that it's trying out. And the reason why the Census Bureau feels it needs to use this new method and not rely on the methods it's used in the past is because with the amount of data that are out there in the world and the computing power that people have, they now have the ability to take these outside data sets and use them to identify people in these tables that they otherwise wouldn't have been able to identify. So it's something that no one has ever been identified in census data. It's a precautionary step to sway things to become more conscious of kind of the world that we're living in today. So that said, what we're seeing happening, and by we, I guess I'm speaking for researchers and a lot of demographers who've been looking at some test products using this differential privacy method. And what we've seen are some pretty wild inaccuracies, especially in small geographies and in rural areas. So the Census Bureau has released some test products that it ran this differential privacy method against the 2010 data that we already have. And then researchers take what we have from before, the 2010 data, and compare it to the data that were just recently released that have been made differentially private. And it looks pretty good at the higher levels of geography, but as you get into more rural areas, things look, they break down pretty quickly. So characteristics of people, like age characteristics, even population totals of townships, of smaller cities, these things in the most recent product that they put out there look really bad. And demographers have told the Census Bureau that, and they have responded by saying, okay, we're gonna try again. They're gonna release something in the next week, which is their last try. And we're gonna look at it and see if there's been an improvement. That's where things stand today.
Can you give us an example of like a characteristic that you look like, that you looked at, maybe population, and it was just wildly off, to give people a sense of like kind of what we're talking about?
Yeah, I mean, one example of this, of how it might play out, and it plays out in different ways, but one example of how it might play out is if the Census Bureau is working to control at a higher level of geography a racially diverse population, then it might displace the people in the data at a lower level of geography. So that didn't sound very concrete. Let me give you a concrete example. Some areas have incarcerated populations. They have correctional facilities that are located, you know, maybe just outside a city. Maybe, for example, Hermantown has one. If you have a population that's incarcerated that is more racially diverse than the population that surrounds it, and those people, their characteristics get shifted to a nearby town, their data is going to look like they are much more racially diverse, and the block with the incarcerated population will not look diverse at all. And so that's just one example of where, yeah, no one can be identified, but it's not accurate data. This isn't something that we can use. You know, this town didn't suddenly become diverse in the last decade. What happened was there was this technique that made it appear that way.
And if I remember correctly, their plan is for this to not only be a part of the decennial census, but they want to start implementing it into the American Community Survey as well, which is, for our listeners, a data set we use at the Center for Rural Policy. You know, for nearly every single research project, we end up using the ACS. Yeah. And, you know, I'll give an example too. When we're doing some of our childcare research, you know, one of the pieces we'll look at a county level is the number of children that have parents that are participating in the labor force, because that can kind of give us an idea of, okay, this mm-hmm. child probably will need childcare because it's under the age of five and has their parents working. But all of those come with a margin of error, right? So it might be like, let's say Candy, Ojai County, where I live. It could be, I'll just throw out a number, you know, it gives an estimate of 200 kids that fit this profile, but the margin of error might be 50. So it's either, you know, 150 or 250, somewhere in between there. And so those margin of error can get pretty big. And so implementing even more noise to that, I mean, I would become very nervous about, I mean, it just becomes not usable. We usually consider anything where the estimate or the margin of error is 25% or more of the actual estimate, it's pretty much unusable. Is that kind of what we're talking about a little bit, is, you know, getting down to that level and it starts to break down?
Yeah, I mean, that's the concern. And that is, that's what we're worried about. We'll see. I mean, the Census Bureau saying this next release is much better. They said they've listened to us. I get where they're coming from. I mean, none of us want to have someone who could be identified in the data.
Susan, I know the decennial census and all the work that goes into that, your office kind of takes the lead on that, does a ton of work, but it wasn't just your office. Is that correct?
It was a lot of work. And we had so many people helping out that I just want to say a big thank you to those of you who helped with the census outreach efforts. We couldn't have done it without, you know, local people talking to neighbors, talking to, you know, people at their church or their local store to tell them this was an important thing to do and a good thing to do for their communities. And here we are. I'm happy to be on this side of it, but thanks to all of you who helped out.
Well, and congrats to you guys too. Everybody talks about the state demographer's office, the ability to work with you guys. You were out in the field helping everybody out. You, major kudos to you guys, and you're beloved among our state agencies. That's great.
Oh, thank you.
Really appreciate it.
You've been listening to the Center of Everywhere podcast, where we explore stories of rural Minnesotans who are making a difference in their communities. Rural isn't in the middle of nowhere. It is in the center of everywhere.